Thursday. A lot of travel, a lot of different things going on with the Titans in the AFC Championship game. John, very understanding, willing to join us on a Thursday. John, really appreciate you hopping on with us to close out the show today.
Yeah, I guess you saved the worst for last, right, Dan? But it's always good to talk to you regardless of the day of the week.
Hey, once again, I want to thank you for coming out last Friday in Baltimore. That was a really fun 45 minutes or so with you telling stories and talking sports live on-site at Tin Roof in Baltimore. That was a lot of fun.
Well, I enjoyed it, and it was good to see you guys up there. And what a night it was Saturday. And the only issue I had Saturday was I almost drove to Orioles Park because it was so warm. I thought it was a baseball night.
It was crazy. And I'm walking around the stadium going into to the press box. I worked up a sweat walking around outside. I mean, it felt like, and John, you've been around a lot of these venues. It felt like an NCAA tournament venue in late March.
Right.
When the weather just starts turning warm, that's the way the air smelled. That's the way it felt in Baltimore this weekend. It was crazy.
Yeah, it really was wild there for both Saturday and Sunday. And I love that kind of weather. Of course, I think we all do. You wouldn't call it football weather per se in January, that's for sure. But it was a wild night in a lot of different ways. And a great night for the Titans and a devastating night for the Ravens, certainly.
What is the level of despair and shock in that region right now with the Ravens going out in game number one of the playoffs for them?
I think it's huge because I think that everybody in Baltimore thought the Ravens were going back to the Super Bowl, and there was no reason really not to think that the way they played during the regular season. They'd won 12 straight games. Lamar Jackson was clearly the MVP of the league. They had a really good defense. I think they had 10 players picked for the Pro Bowl, some ridiculous number like that. And I think the assumption was that the Titans would come in and give them a good game, because I don't think they disrespected the Titans in any way, but that they would come in, give them a good game, and Lamar Jackson would make plays at the end and they'd win. And then they'd get Kansas City at home, and that would be a tremendous game too. But that, again, playing at home, they should win and go to the Super Bowl. But honestly, that game wasn't as close as 28-12. I mean, it was one-sided from the very beginning. I mean, it was 14-0 before you could look up and snap your fingers. And the Ravens, even though they drove the ball and picked up large chunks of yardage, really never threatened the Titans at all. And I think that was stunning to everyone in Baltimore. And to go out with a whimper that way after such a tremendous regular season is something. You know, I wrote a column in the Washington Post the next day in which I said the next time they'll realistically get a chance to make up for this in some way will be in next year's playoffs, because they can go 16-0 next year in the regular season and everybody will be saying, yeah, but what happens in January? And so they've got a long wait before they can attempt some kind of redemption.
Well, and with Lamar Jackson, immediately the second guessing starts. Okay, that was a great regular season. He's the MVP, but can he get it done in the playoffs? He accounted for over 500 yards in that game. And what's crazy, John, is I'm sitting there watching the entire game. I didn't think he played all that well, yet he still accounted for over 500 yards. I thought the decision on the fourth down sneak, where instead of just going right up the middle, he tries to circle around and loses 2 yards on fourth down. You know, there was a couple of high passes in the game, but he still accounted for over 500 yards. Completely opposite performance of a year ago in the playoffs, but it still kind of leaves that city and that fan base scratching their head a little bit. I mean, it's not difficult to know what to do with Lamar Jackson moving forward. You do exactly what you did this past season. But I can understand some question marks popping up. But again, it wasn't Lamar Jackson's fault that the Ravens lost that game.
Yeah, and you know, because the football playoffs are the way they are, you build a reputation, either good or bad, on one game or two games or three games. And, you know, Lamar Jackson's now 0-2 as a playoff starter, and people will go, oh, well, you know, maybe he's not the same quarterback he is in January that he is in the regular season. I don't think that's the case. I think Lamar Jackson will eventually have an outstanding playoff legacy because I think he's a great player. You remember John Elway was the guy who couldn't win the Super Bowl until he won two Super Bowls. Dan Marino only made it to one Super Bowl. They're both clear-cut Hall of Famers. And so I think any judgment in football is often premature, And this is an example of that. Like you said, that was a team effort Saturday night on both the Titans and the Ravens' part. And Lamar Jackson did not have a great game, but a mediocre, and let's call it that, Lamar Jackson game is still better than 90% of the quarterbacks in the league.
Boy, a mediocre Joe Burrow game for LSU. I think we're still trying to find one this season. 60 touchdown passes. If you look at LSU quarterbacks, the previous four seasons combined, they threw 59 touchdowns. He throws for 60 in one season. What a performance by LSU, John. And do you feel like with this season they just had, this offensive performance, Joe Burrow winning the Heisman, we don't want to get too much into recency bias, but boy, it certainly does look like one of the four or five greatest college football teams of all time.
Well, and a lot of it, Chad, goes back to who they beat over the course of the year. I mean, they won at Alabama. They beat a very good Georgia team in the SEC playoffs or championship game. They beat Auburn, a very good team. They dominated Oklahoma, the fourth-ranked team in the country, and they pretty much, once they got going, dominated Clemson, which had won 29 straight games and I think was also an outstanding team. And Burrow's numbers were ridiculous, obviously. The thing that I carry with me is listening to his post-game interview after the Alabama game, in which I think he had 7 touchdown passes and ran for a touchdown. And he said, very sort of matter-of-factly, he said, yeah, I was a little bit off tonight, but still we were able to overcome that. I think he was 24 of 29 or something. That's how good he was, that he expected of himself pretty much perfection and came about as close to it as you can as a quarterback. And they, as a team, they gave up points here and there, but it ultimately it didn't matter because their offense was so incredibly potent. And it was, to me, again, because of who they beat along the way and the way they beat them, this is one of the great college football seasons ever. If you want to rank them or something, I don't know whether it be 1 or 3 or 5, whatever, but it's certainly right up there on the list.
How about Odell Beckham Jr. just handing out cash on the field to LSU players? And I also want to applaud Joe Burrow for showing the honesty to just come out and say what everyone out there knows. No, it was real money. I can say that now that my eligibility is up, but it absolutely was real money that he was handing out, even though LSU claims it was fake money that he was handing out.
Yeah, you know, God almighty, I don't know where to start on that. First of all, Odell Beckham Jr. is an idiot. He has to know he's on the sidelines. He knows he's going to draw camera attention. He probably wanted the camera attention. He wanted somehow to be part of the story, even though he wasn't part of the story in LSU winning the national championship. So he does this idiotic thing with the money. And then LSU, as you said, ridiculously comes out and says it's counterfeit. Really? Come on. And I love the fact that Burrow said, I'm no longer, quote, a student athlete. There was clear sarcasm in that comment. And it's just, and again, the fact that this would be something the NCAA might, quote, investigate, the NCAA ought to just say, hey, fellas, give the money back. Or, you know, in the case of Burrow and other seniors, but yeah, it's fine because you're not playing anymore, and get it over with. I mean, the last thing you need after what LSU did was some kind of silly NCAA investigation, which you know would end up with them saying, you know, we're fining them $1,000 or something stupid like that. It was just a totally ridiculous situation, and it could only happen in college sports because so many of the rules are so silly.
When we come back, plenty to talk about with cheating in baseball. We'll talk with John Feinstein of the Washington Post about that when we return. This is the Midday 180 on 104.5 The Zone. Some firings this past week. Where do we begin with this whole saga that is it starts in Houston, spreads to Boston with Alex Cora? When you just look at everything in totality right now, what are your main thoughts on everything that's gone down?
You know, it really starts, Chad, with replay. And I have had mixed emotions about replay in all sports almost from the beginning. I understand the idea you want to get every call right, especially critical calls. But can we agree that replay has not done that? I mean, ask the New Orleans Saints. And go on from there. And what replay has done, in my opinion, is it's delayed the games in all sports. It's made umpiring and refereeing worse because umps and refs are intimidated by replay and they're afraid to make definitive calls one way or the other because they know replay's coming in behind them. And now it's created arguably the worst game, other than steroids, which is an ongoing problem for at least 25 years and still stains the sport every year when the Hall of Fame votes come out because guys who have numbers that clearly should make them Hall of Famers are left out, and they should be, by the way, because they're cheaters, and you should not be able to cheat your way into the Hall of Fame, although, again, the Basketball Hall of Fame has all sorts of college coaches who've been convicted by the NCAA in there, another subject for another day. But now we've got this horrible, horrible cheating scandal, which there's no doubt that it happened. It's not a he said, he said. It did happen. MLB, you know, MLB would have liked to have investigated and come back and said, we found nothing. But they found plenty. And it's not just that AJ Hinch got fired, that Jeff Luhnow got fired, that Alex Cora got fired, that Carlos Beltran may get fired by the Mets without ever managing a game. It's that it stains two World Series champions. And the players who are being let off the hook, the players who are involved, are going to be stained, whether they're suspended, which they won't be, or anything like that. But every one of those guys carries that stain. Whenever one of those players retires on the Astros or the Red Sox, and it's going to say, you know, so-and-so who was on the Houston Astros team that won the 2017 World Series but was later found to be guilty of stealing signs technologically. That's going to be part of their legacy. And it's, you know, we still talk about the Black Sox 100 years later. I won't be, you won't be, but people will still be talking about this 100 years from now.
John, here's, and I'm going to speak for Jonathan Hutton, who's on his way to Kansas City right now, who brought this up. Hutton is a great conspiracy theorist. He always sees the conspiracy behind everything. And he brought up this point. He said, you know, there's a lot of people who are very quiet on this. And it took one former player of the Astros to blow the whistle on this and talk about it. But there seems to be a lot of silence and not a lot of condemnation from the rest of the league, which was leading him to believe this is something that happens other places that's not talked about. If you remember at the start of the steroid controversy, it was, oh, I cannot believe someone's doing this. And then suddenly it's sort of slowly trickled that, oh, a lot of people are doing this.
Right.
There's people on every team that's doing this. Do you buy into that at all, or do you think this is an isolated thing with the Astros that wasn't widespread?
I'm going to come down in the middle.
Okay.
I'm going to say it's not isolated, that there are more teams probably doing it than the two that have been publicly outed by MLB. But I don't think it, I doubt if it's all 30 teams doing it. But I do think there are probably other teams doing it. Chad, remember that in different ways, this has been going on in baseball for years. Now, I'm not just talking about, you know, stealing a sign from second base, which is considered part of the game. The New York Giants, their clubhouse was in the Polo Grounds, was in center field. And in the 1950s, including 1951, you know, the Bobby Thompson miracle home run, they were accused of stealing signs by having a camera in the center in their clubhouse that could shoot towards, you know, there was enough of a zoom lens even back then that they could steal catcher signs. So this has been going on in one form or another forever, that if you can get an edge. And one of the things that bothers me about this, Chad, is listening to radio and reading people, is this notion that, well, everybody does it. So it's, you know, it's the old thing in politics. Everybody does it. No, everybody doesn't do it. Everybody wasn't taking steroids. A lot of people were. Tom Glavine, who was one of the main people in the MLB union and knew everybody, players on every team, said that he estimated that at least 25% during the height of the steroid era were taking steroids on a regular basis, and probably close to 50% of the players had tried it at some point along the way. That's a very, very high number. That's an epidemic, but it's not everybody. And I think it's probably like that with the sign stealing. Maybe 25% could be as high as 50. That's an epidemic, and that's a problem. But it's not everybody. I don't think everybody's doing it. I think that there are teams and management teams that know that something like that is wrong and wouldn't allow it to happen.
Are we too quick to anoint NFL coaches as great or as phenoms or as the next great coach? And I'll give you an example. Sean McVay, he was terrific at the start and took over a team that was bad, immediately transformed them. They weren't as good this year. They fell off a bit. You're starting to hear some of this now with Mike Vrabel here in Nashville. A couple of 9-7 seasons. The 9-7 this year was better because it got them in the playoffs, and now they're on a great playoff run right now. And suddenly I'm hearing some national conversation about, boy, Mike Vrabel is the next great NFL coach. Your thoughts on Mike Vrabel and your thoughts on the possibility that maybe we're too quick at times to anoint coaches as the next great thing, even though I think Mike Vrabel's done a hell of a job and is a great young coach.
Well, I think, Chad, we're too quick to go in both directions. We're too quick to anoint. We're too quick to condemn. I've always said that really almost in any sport, you need 5 years, especially at the pro level. To determine whether somebody's a good coach or a bad coach. Sometimes you take over, you've got really good players, you've got young players who develop at the right moment, and you have success, and then it turns out you're not all that good. Other times it's the other way around. Joe Gibbs was 0-5 his first season in Washington, and they wanted to run him out of town at that point. And we all know what happened with Joe Gibbs. Bill Belichick got fired in Cleveland after 5 years, made the playoffs once, got fired. And we all know he turned out to be a pretty good coach. I don't think you can judge someone good or bad in a short period of time. And we are in an era now, and really in every sport. I mean, look at hockey. They've already had 7 coaches fired halfway through the season this year. Coaches get recycled. I mean, Pete DeBoer, I think, has coached like 8 teams in the last 5 years. It feels that way anyway. But there's a tendency, because we live in an instant gratification era, where if you don't get it done in 2 years or 3 years, you're fired. If you have success the first 2 or 3 years, you're right. You're the next great, great thing. Now, for a player, it's different. If you're really good, it's going to show up in the first couple of years. I mean, we knew how good Mike Trout was almost the day he put on an Angels uniform. I remember Dwight Gooden when he was 19. And how incredible he was at that point in his career. And if not for drugs, who knows what kind of a record he would have ultimately had. But with coaches, I think it's different. I think you need more time. I don't think winning one championship makes you a Hall of Famer. And I don't think one 6-10 season makes you someone who should be fired.
John, do the Titans keep this run going in Kansas City, or does it end on Sunday in the AFC Championship?
You know how I am about picking games, Chad. Although I did say that I thought the Titans were going to go in and beat the Patriots. I think I got that one right.
Yep.
I wasn't alone, obviously. I think they certainly have a chance to win. You don't win at New England and at Baltimore without being a very good football team at this stage. They're getting exactly what they need out of Ryan Tannehill. Trying to tackle Derrick Henry is like trying to stand in front of a bus and stop it. He's just so overwhelming at this moment. The defense has been terrific. They gave up a lot of yards on Saturday night, but ultimately they were meaningless yards.
They made a lot of plays too. That's what balanced it out.
Yeah, exactly. And they had the 3 turnovers and the 2 fourth down stops, which were huge. They scored on 4 of those 5 turnovers. I'm counting the fourth down stops as turnovers. I think they have an absolute chance to win. Whether they can stop, and I don't think the crowd matters. You know, everybody talks about how loud the crowd is in Kansas City. At this stage, when the teams are this good, it doesn't matter. The last time the Titans played in there, they were down 20 in the playoffs. They were down 21-3, came back and won. So do I think they have a chance to win? Absolutely, I think they have a chance to win. If you asked me to bet my house on it, I would say I'd rather bet your house.
John Feinstein, the good news is we don't have to bet anyone's house on this. we're just speculating on what might happen.
I think it'll be a 24-21 type of game, one way or the other.
There you go. John Feinstein, Washington Post, joins us weekly here on the Midday 1A. John, thanks so much. We'll talk to you again next week.
I'll look forward to it, Chad. Safe travels.
Absolutely. And next time we talk to you on the Midday 180, we will be coming to you live from Kansas City tomorrow, Johnny's Tavern in the Power and Light District. Looking forward to getting together with a bunch of Titans fans over the weekend. That is the spot tomorrow, Friday. That is the spot on Saturday. All day, Titans Road Rally, 7 o'clock Saturday night, Johnny's Tavern in the Power and Light District in Kansas City. If you're headed up to Kansas City, stop by and see us there. It's been a fun show. It's going to be a big-time show tomorrow as the best playoff coverage with the Titans continues tomorrow on the Midday 180. Signing off now, I guess I'll say don't block the box for Paul Koharski. We are on our way to the airport. We'll talk to you tomorrow from Kansas City. This is the Midday 180, 104.5 The Zone.